member, and he will be missed is an understatement.
Well, Patrice Cullors, again, our deepest condolences, cousin of Kenan Anderson, who died after being tased by police in Los Angeles. Patrice Cullors is co-founder of Black Lives Matter and a founder of Reform LA Jails. Her books include When They Call You a Terrorist, Black Lives Matter Memoir, and An Abolitionist Handbook, 12 Steps to Changing Yourself and the World. And again today at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, Democracy Now! Will be live streaming the Belmarsh Tribunal that is being held as pressure is growing on President Biden to drop charges against Julian Assange. He's being held in the Belmarsh prison in London, has been held for almost 4 years. Among those who will be testifying are Noam Chomsky, as well as Daniel Ellsberg. Ben Wisner will also be there, the ACLU lawyer for Ed Snowden. Katrina Vandenhoevel, the publisher of The Nation magazine. I will be co-chairing the Belmarsh Tribunal. Again, you can watch it at democracynow.org at 2 Eastern Standard Time. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/KBoomRadio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/KBOO.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/KBOO Radio.
We also provide content to the Free Music Archive,
an interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
This is KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, FBI warns of attacks on Northwest power grids.
Supreme Court can't figure out who leaked a major decision.
And in international news, Peruvian capital rocked by protests.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 20th, 2023. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. Attacks on power stations are on the rise in the Northwest. Damage to these systems can cut off critical services to thousands of people. The region is now considered a hotspot for these assaults. There have been 15 attacks since June 2022, more than the previous 6 years combined. It is unclear whether or not the attacks are connected. In most of them, no one has been arrested, and no one has claimed responsibility. Neo-Nazis and other far-right extremists have allegedly disseminated how-to manuals online. Some hate groups have said that taking down the grid will hasten the demise of the federal government and start a race war. A recent alert from FBI headquarters warned of an increase of threats to electrical infrastructure from racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists. Another bulletin from the FBI's Portland office says specific attacks in Oregon and Washington were carried out using firearms, hand tools, flames, and chains. The bulletin stated, quote, "No theft was reported, making it apparent that the intent was likely to disable electrical systems and not for monetary profit," end quote. The incident seemed to accelerate at the end of the year, with 10 of 15 attacks in 2022 taking place in November and December.
Federal data also shows the West to be the hotspot for international damage to electrical infrastructure. For intentional damage to electrical infrastructure, the Western grid serves 11 Western states, plus British Columbia and Alberta. It had more physical attacks in the first 8 months of 2022 than the rest of North America combined. Protecting a vast electrical network against intentional attacks is very difficult and quite costly. About 700,000 miles of transmission lines crisscross the continent. There are more than 50,000 substations. The rash of attacks has led to conversations about additional security. There are a number of proposed measures to protect the grid and keep America's lights on. They range from bulletproof coats of armor that fit over transformers to artificial intelligence. The armor can apparently protect substations from threats, including high-powered rifles, as well as vehicles laden with explosives. Artificial intelligence programs can scan many video streams at once for anything unusual and alert humans to potential problems. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission launched a 4-month study to try to determine whether physical security measures should be mandated all power plants, substations, and control centers nationwide. How that might translate to increased costs for electricity remains unknown. The FBI says people should report suspicious activity near substations to law enforcement.
Oregon nurses want state legislators to establish minimum staffing numbers so they're not taking care of more patients than they have the capacity for. KBOO's Nina Mayfair has more on the story.
Oregon nurses say they're struggling under high patient loads and they want state lawmakers to do something about it. The Oregon Nurses Association is backing a safe staffing bill this session, which would set minimums for the number of nurses in particular units of the hospital. There would be no more than 3 patients per nurse in the emergency department, for example. Paige Spence with the Oregon Nurses Association says this will help nurses and patients.
So no matter what else happens in the creation or enforcement of that staffing plan, the nurse has certainty and therefore a patient has certainty in the level of their care that a nurse will not have too many patients.
Spence notes that nurses are leaving the profession in high numbers. An Oregon Center for Nursing Analysis says the profession ranked 7th out of over 430 occupations for most open positions in 2021. However, the industry is pushing back on this legislation. The Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems calls it a one-size solution for a more complex problem. Spence says a 2015 law established nurse staffing committees to come up with plans that set in place minimum numbers for nurses in different departments. But those standards haven't been enforced, which is why she believes they need to be made law.
Higher staffing levels are associated with a reduction in medication errors, ulcers, need for restraints, lower rates of infection, and lower rates of pneumonia. And the most important is the decrease of mortality when there is safer staffing levels.
Spence says the bill will require the Oregon Health Authority to enforce staffing plans and open up the ability for nurses to file civil suits if the plans aren't followed. It would also set up staffing committee structures for other workers in the hospital, like technicians and respiratory therapists. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Nina Mayfair.
The Supreme Court investigated the leak of their draft opinion overturning Roe v. Wade last year. But the report says they still don't know who leaked the draft. At least 90 people had access to the document, at least one point. The investigative team says it's unlikely the leak resulted from a computer hack. Investigators conducted 126 formal interviews of 97 employees, all of whom denied disclosing the opinion. They also conducted a fingerprint analysis looking for connections between employees and reporters. A few employees did admit to telling their spouses about the draft opinion or the vote count of the justices. It is not known whether that led to further investigation or disciplinary action. The report does not say if justices or their spouses were interviewed. The investigation focused on court personnel who had or could have had access to the draft opinion during the period from the initial circulation until the publication by Politico. Employees were asked to sign affidavits, under penalty of perjury, to affirm that they did not disclose the draft opinion. They were also asked to swear to the truth of the statements before a notary public.
The leak was the worst breach of confidentiality in the court's history. It became public on May 2nd, when Politico published a draft opinion reversing a landmark 1973 decision that established a constitutional right to abortion. Gail Curley is the marshal of the court. Curley says the court should implement better policies concerning sensitive information. The report noted the Supreme Court's documenting system doesn't have substantial logging and search functions, making it difficult for investigators to analyze the IT logs. Investigators collected court-issued laptops and mobile devices from everyone who had access to the draft opinion, but found no relevant information from those devices. All employees who were asked to turn over the call and text records from their personal phones did, the report says. Michael Chertoff is a former federal appellate judge and Secretary of Homeland Security who was hired to assess the investigation. He listed four recommendations to ensure a future leak does not happen. These include restricting the distribution of hard copy versions of sensitive documents and limiting the access of sensitive information on outside mobile devices. The court has previously remained silent about the investigation, not releasing any official updates.
U.S. mayors discuss local policing policies. The Supreme Court releases a report concerning the leaked Dobbs opinion, and there's already significant debate over the U.S. debt ceiling. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira and 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Our current debt is entirely unsustainable. And if we don't have a deal for any sort of budget reform by the time that vote happens, that's going to be very problematic. And it's not something that I'm going to be supportive of.
Representative Nancy Mace wonders how the potential political showdown over raising the debt ceiling will play out in the next couple of months. The U.S. reached its debt ceiling on Thursday, something Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned of in a letter to Congress. For now, the Treasury Department has taken extraordinary measures to ensure the nation doesn't default on its debt. While these measures can keep the country from defaulting until early June, Yellen said Congress needs to act promptly to keep the country afloat. As the legislative session gets underway, Republican House leadership will be looking to delve into some issues outlined in their Commitment to America plan. One such issue is education, with a focus being placed on helping students make up for pandemic learning loss, expanding school choice, and advancing the Parents' Bill of Rights. This particular piece of legislation would codify a set of rights to make public education more transparent to parents. Frederick Hess with the American Enterprise Institute describes why this is so necessary.
What I think the Republicans are doing here, and quite appropriate, is saying we have to have some guardrails about what is and is not considered a civil liberty for parents and families and taxpayers.
The plan will also be looking into health care proposals. Some issues Republicans want to cover include personalizing care to provide affordable options and better quality, and getting lower prices through transparency, choice, and competition. A recent Gallup poll finds 38% of people surveyed delayed medical treatment due to cost. While this Congress may be divided on numerous issues, Marilyn Serafini with the Bipartisan Policy Center said this is an area where bipartisanship can shine.
We have Democrats and Republicans that have consistently been focused on lowering costs, in particular drug costs, and this comes from the American people.
During the U.S. Conference of Mayors, several experts discussed problems with police retention and recruitment. According to a survey from the Police Executive Research Forum, resignations increased from 2020 to 2021 by 40.4%. Chuck Wexler with the Police Executive Research Forum said police departments are in a triage situation now.
We're trying to reform agencies and hire the best and the brightest. At that very moment, we're facing the challenge of a 3.5% unemployment rate in the country, where teachers and military are also facing this.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, a behind-the-scenes look at today's headlines. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. At 7, it's Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will show areas of fog. The low will be 31. Tomorrow will be cloudy with some showers. The high will be 43. Today in history, in 1942, senior Nazi officials met outside Berlin to discuss the final solution to the Jewish question. The quote of the day is from Elie Wiesel, Nobel Prize winner and Holocaust survivor, who said, "Action is the only remedy to indifference, the most insidious danger of all."
Thousands of protesters are demanding the removal of Peruvian President Dina Boluarte at the nation's capital, Lima. Many came from remote regions where dozens have already died in civil unrest. The protests have been marked by Peru's worst political violence in more than two decades, and they highlight divisions between the country's urban elite, largely concentrated in Lima, and poor rural areas. Protesters chanted calls for Boluarte's resignation. Street sellers were selling t-shirts saying, "Dina murderer, Peru repudiates you." At least 13 civilians and four police officers were injured in the Lima protests yesterday. 22 more police officers and 16 more civilians were injured throughout the country. Boluarte gave a televised speech last night. She thanked police for controlling, quote-unquote, the violent protests, and vowed to prosecute those responsible for violence. Boluarte has said she supports a plan to hold elections for president and Congress in 2024, 2 years before originally scheduled. Demonstrators apparently hope to give fresh weight to the movement that began when Boluarte was sworn into office on December 7th. Activists have labeled a demonstration in Lima as the Cuatro Suyos March, a reference to the four cardinal points of the Inca Empire. It's also the name of a massive mobilization in 2000, when thousands of Peruvians took to the streets against the autocratic government. The latest protests have largely been grassroots efforts without a clear leadership. Some believe demonstrators won't be satisfied with Boluarte's resignation and want more fundamental structural reform. Concern over sparking a true civil war remains.
A Washington state bill addresses the thoroughness of medical exams done in workers' comp cases. Eric Tegetoff has more on that story.
Washington state lawmakers have introduced a bill that would address some workers' concerns about the thoroughness of medical exams performed in workers' compensation cases. House Bill 1068 would allow workers to record examinations of their injuries, which are known as independent medical exams or compelled exams. Joe Kindo is with the Washington State Labor Council, which is made up of about 600 local unions representing more than 500,000 workers. He says this bill would create the same standards for workers' compensation as other insurance cases.
By allowing recordings, by allowing somebody who's not the worker's attorney to attend the examination, we'll get a much clearer record and we'll ensure that the docs who are doing the compelled examination are doing a thorough exam.
In a hearing on the legislation, Carolyn Logue with the Washington IME Coalition expressed concerns on behalf of some medical providers. She says it would lead to fewer doctors who are willing to do the exams, which could slow down the process. Kindo says doctors' reports would be more complete if they included a recording for reference. He says workers have expressed concerns that providers are not performing the necessary examinations to assess their injuries, and disagreeing with the assessments can be an uphill battle.
When the worker is appealing their claim, this is the evidence that they're having to bring before the Board of Industrial Insurance Appeals, and then it just becomes worker versus the doctor in a very contentious setting, and that's a lot for a worker to overcome.
Kindo says workers' livelihoods often are on the line in these cases.
Their ability to retain their wage replacement benefits or get the medical treatment they need hinges on the opinion of these docs who aren't their usual attending physician or they're not the specialist that is treating their workplace injury. So there's a lot on the line.
An executive session in the House Committee on Labor and Workplace Standards for this bill is scheduled for today. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegetoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is blocking a high school advanced placement course in African American studies. Trimmel Gomes has more on the story.
The administration of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has rejected plans to expand an advanced placement African American studies course for high schools, claiming it violates state law and calling it historically inaccurate. In a letter to the College Board that oversees AP programs, the Florida Department of Education rejects the teachings over concerns that the lessons run contrary to state law and significantly lack educational value. Attorney Mutaki Akbar, president of the NAACP Tallahassee branch, says it's unfortunate to see the governor take this step.
There's value in education, no matter what that education is, and so to carve out the value of learning about African Americans or the culture of African Americans has no value, I think, is a slap in the face, and blatantly, I think, is racist.
The pilot program debuted at 60 schools across the country and is slated to expand to others. Details of the curriculum have not yet been made public, but the coursework reportedly includes speeches by Malcolm X, the Black Panther Party's free breakfast and medical programs, and the history of Juneteenth, the national holiday commemorating the end of slavery after the Civil War. The Education Department has not named which law it contends the course is violating. The move is part of the latest crackdown on how race is taught in schools. Akbar says his organization will continue to fight the changes. He says a judge has already ruled the DeSantis so-called Stop Woke Act, which regulates lessons on race, is unconstitutional.
I think we organized the same way they organized in the 60s, same way they organized in the 70s. I think we get the same energy back that brought these programs into the schools in the first place, to get them back in eventually, or to just continue to educate our own children.
In announcing its rejection of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, the Florida Department of Education did leave the door open for accepting the course later, stating that in the future, should the College Board be willing to come back to the table with lawful, historically accurate content, FDOE will always be willing to reopen the discussion. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A bill to name a section of highway on the Blackfeet Reservation after the late Chief Earl Oldperson is heading through the Montana legislature. And the cause underlying a savage polar bear attack in Alaska remains a mystery. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A bill to name a section of highway on the Blackfeet Reservation after the late Chief Earl Oldperson is making its way through the Montana legislature. Aaron Bolton has more.
Chief Oldperson was not just the hereditary chief and longtime political leader of the Blackfeet Nation. He was a well-known figure that worked on national pieces of legislation like the American Indian Religious Freedom Act and led the National Congress of American Indians throughout his lifetime. Now, legislation would designate a portion of U.S. Highway 89 in Chief Oldperson's honor. The bill has been met with some opposition from Republican lawmakers who say there are better ways to honor the Blackfeet leader, but the bill passed the state Senate with bipartisan support. The legislation is now on its way over to the House for consideration. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
For now, the reasons for a polar bear attack in Alaska this week remains a mystery. Alaska state troopers say a polar bear killed a woman and her child in Wales, in a Inupiat village about 100 miles northwest of Nome. As the community grieves, scientists and other local experts who help to manage wildlife in the region have begun the difficult process of trying to find out more about what happened. Jeff York, the senior conservation director at Polar Bears International, talked with Alaska Public Media about the attack. He says investigators need to tread lightly to balance the need for information with respect for the community.
It's difficult to do in these times as people are traumatized, you know, by what happened, but it's also critically important that we get as much information from these events as possible so we can, you know, share lessons learned and share information with other communities going forward. The end goal is to, you know, try to keep people safe.
Polar bear attacks are extremely rare in Alaska. The last one took place in 1990. Since then, the impacts of shrinking sea ice on marine life due to a warming climate have escalated. But York says there's plenty of sea ice in the region right now, enough for the bears to hunt for marine mammals, which provide them with the high energy diet necessary for their survival. York cautions against jumping to conclusions about whether sea ice played a role in the attack.
Historically, so even going back beyond written records, polar bears have attacked and killed people, potentially for food, regardless of sea ice conditions. So linking one event to this larger environmental phenomenon that's ongoing today is always a bit risky. That being said, we know that the Chukchi Sea has experienced dramatic changes in sea ice.
Although sea ice is in place right now, York says it's hard to know what's happening in the habitat below, which might impact the food supply. He also says scientists do not have enough information about the circumstances surrounding the attack and the condition of the bear.
They'll look at the age of the bear, the health of the bear, if they can, the sex of the bear, and then they'll talk to local community members about events leading up to and during the event itself and just try to get as much information as possible.
State troopers say 24-year-old Summer Myomic and her 1-year-old son were on a walk between the school and the local clinic when the polar bear struck. A community member shot and killed the bear. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland is in Arizona to gather testimony about Indian boarding school experiences. Haaland is leading a national investigation into the impacts on tribal communities from federal Indian boarding school policy. A gathering is scheduled for Friday in Phoenix and Sunday on the Navajo Nation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
When humans cause gray wolf deaths, it has a huge impact on the pack. Mike Moen tells more.
They thrive when one of their members dies as a result of human activity. That's according to a new study, which comes amid calls to ban a bear hunting practice at a Wisconsin site to protect wildlife. Researchers say wolves sometimes venture out of protected sites like national parks, and when one is killed by poaching or struck by a vehicle, the chances of its pack staying together decrease by 27%. If it's a pack leader, group stability decreases by more than 70%. Kira Cassidy of Yellowstone National Park led the research, says these impacts don't always surface in population estimates, but they're just as important.
We know that wolf packs live in these family groups where each wolf kind of has their own set of responsibilities and tasks, especially the leaders. And so when a pack loses one of those, it is the most detrimental.
The study also cites a negative effect on reproduction. In Wisconsin, conservation and wildlife groups are asking the U.S. Forest Service to ban hounding in Wisconsin's Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. Because of federal protections, wolves can't be hunted, but the petition says there are still violent encounters between hunting dogs and wolves, even when other animals are being hunted. The Center for Biological Diversity is among the groups seeking the ban, where Colette Atkins says it's a matter of public safety, too, with people hiking through forests sometimes surrounded by hunting dogs. She feels the activity is a stark contrast to the purpose of these sites.
We don't think this type of hunting has any place in our national forests, which really should be a haven for wildlife.
On a broader scale, some pro-hunting groups and farmers' advocates say wolves prey on livestock that need to be protected. Separately, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is in the process of updating its wolf management plan. The public comment period has been extended to February 28th. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Schools lack formal programs aimed at helping them deal with extreme heat. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate warms, many schools are facing more frequent hot days, and extreme heat is not just a nuisance. It can hinder learning and make kids sick.
When you think about kids being outside on the playground running around, if they're dehydrated before they even start running around, they could get seriously ill.
That's Melissa Guadaro, an assistant research professor at Arizona State University. She says schools often lack a formal approach to deal with the threat, so she's part of a project started by one of her graduate students to change that. Called Heat Ready Schools, it identifies a set of best practices schools can follow to prepare for and respond to extreme heat. For example, making sure that at least 50% of a playground is shaded.
So that's not just a blacktop playground and kids are just roasting out there.
The program suggests that schools provide reusable water bottles so kids can stay hydrated and schedule outdoor activities when it's not as hot. Other recommendations include training teachers and staff to recognize the signs of heat-related illness and monitoring students for symptoms. By encouraging schools to prioritize heat safety, the program aims to protect kids as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 20th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The remote production team for tonight's newscast is Nina Mayfair. The producer is Josh Salem. And our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Mike Moen, Eric Tegadoff, Antonio Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizovitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind.